And with our special guest tonight, Neil Adams. Now, Neil sent us four types of animation, and they're posted on the coasttocoastam.com website. I'm going to play for you the audio of one of them, the animation of Planet Earth. And, you know, a picture is worth a thousand words, quite frankly, but if you have a computer, you've got the luxury of seeing this incredible animation. But if you don't, listen to the audio and just try to picture what he's talking about. Here it is. I tell you, it makes a lot of sense. A lot of sense indeed. We'll be back now with Neil Adams in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Neil, now the theory of Pangaea, of course, shows exactly as you have illustrated how these land masses split apart, but it doesn't talk about the possibility that the planet was much smaller at the time.
Right.
Do you believe your theory, based on what you've heard, because of the fact that it's hard to believe that all that land mass was in one small area?
Well, before I answer that, just let me warn anybody who's sending me an email right now that says I should know that a duckbill platypus is a monotreme and not a marsupial. I know it's a monotreme. It's a little edit thing there. Yes, a duckbill platypus is a monotreme. Don't send me the email. But yeah, got it. Okay. But yeah, of course it was shocking to me. I mean, the concept to imagine that all the continents, you know, you could push them together and they would all match and it would be on this planet that would be, well, of course, if you count the continental plane, it wouldn't be quite one quarter the size, but essentially very, very small, about the size of Mars. Shocking, shocking. But when you add it to all the other facts, the size of the dinosaurs, the thinness of the atmosphere, the lack of a thick crust that would make the mountains, after all, people don't quite realize that the Rocky Mountains are only about 30 million years old. They don't realize that the Himalayas are only about 40 million years old. They think that they were there for, you know,
since the inception of the planet. Yeah.
Yeah, not true. It's all new stuff. The Earth, essentially, if you go by this theory, and please, I'm not asking anybody to accept this theory. It's just a discussion. Don't jump on me and say I'm trying to change everything. But if you think about it, if the Earth grew, logically, it would have grown as a process, and it would have happened exponentially. It would have happened increasingly. It would have started out quite small, and then it would have grown very, very slowly for a long period of time. And then as time went by and as the energy increased, then it would have grown more quickly. And it kind of explains, if that's the case, why the last 60 million years were much faster growing than the previous 60 million years. So it's a kind of a progression thing. And there are proofs all over the place, except that people don't look for them. For example, you know, you have Enceladus. You've been talking about Enceladus lately, mm-hmm. That moon of Saturn.
That has gushing water now.
Yes, it has gushing water. Now, people think of it a certain way. And, of course, I think of it from a slightly different point of view. I've been dealing with photos of Enceladus for a while. And if you look at the photos, you'll notice that there are cracks, if you look at especially the close-ups. You look at these cracks. Now, if you were to get down on the ground, it'd look like Arizona. You know, you get these big cracks and rifts that run up.
That's right.
So if you were to take a pair of scissors and you were to cut one of those photos right up the cracks and slide those cracks together, essentially you'd be making Enceladus a little bit smaller. You'd keep on sliding those cracks together. After a while, you'd have a smaller planet. And you'd notice that if you look at different parts of the planet, there's lots of cracks under the land that seem to have pulled apart. Now, if you consider that for just a minute, and then you consider the fact that it's like nature has gone and squeezed this lemon and is spraying all this water out into space, shouldn't that mean that Enceladus is getting smaller? I mean, how long has that water been spraying out into space? We look at it now and we say, well, okay, so maybe it's, a gallon a second or whatever the amount is.
Whatever it is, yeah.
A pitcher an hour. Whatever that is, then you have to ask yourself, how long has this been going on? Let's say, 100 million years?
All right.
5 million years? Pick a number. However long it's been going on, you have to multiply what you see now by whatever that time is. That means that there's a whole lot of water inside that moon being sprayed out over time. Why isn't it shrinking? Is there a big hole inside? In other words, if you take a water gun and you spray that water gun, after a while, that water gun's going to be empty, and then you're going to have a big old empty water gun. Well, I don't know why people aren't quite thinking about it that way, but if I were to look at Enceladus, I would say, well, if all this water is spraying out, who's making it? Where's it coming from? And where's the big hole that it's emptying? Because it must be there, or else Enceladus is making that water.
Just like the planet Earth did, based on your thoughts.
I'm not saying that it's true. I'm simply saying, from a logical point of view, if you look at it and you see the water spraying out, there's got to be some empty space that that's coming from, because my water gun would run out a long time ago.
But you know, it makes you think, and it could be true, because some of the other explanations don't make sense. I just said right before the break, I don't believe that our oceans got filled up by comets bringing in water balls.
It really doesn't.
Ice balls. I don't believe it.
Now, the problem is that we've had a history, and the history about 150 years ago, there were these thinkers. Some of them were scientists, but some of them were thinkers. And, you know, we got out of this idea that the sun was traveling around the Earth and all these very wrong-thinking type of things. And we realized that space was very big. About 150 years ago, thinkers said to us, well, this is how it all worked. What happened was that there was all this stuff gathered in one area of space, chunks and meteorites and all kinds of things. And along comes gravity, a late arrival, galloping up on his horse, and he starts spinning all this stuff together, and it all collects into a sun and all these planets. And that's how our solar system was made. Now, we have that same kind, oddly enough, we have that same kind of thinking going on today. That's pretty much what we teach in school. That's the kind of thinking that's been going on for 150 years.
Yep,
and I
changed.
Say, excuse me, there must be a Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster who created Superman, and there must be somewhere, because it doesn't make sense that they disappeared. Well, it doesn't make sense to me that there was a whole lot of stuff waiting around to be turned into a solar system. It just doesn't make sense. And if you go back and you look at meteorites, there's only one kind of meteorite that falls to Earth now that existed 4.5 billion years ago. And it's not the kind of meteorite that really gets made on a planet. Most of the meteorites that you get that fall from space, not most, but the ones that are made of silicate or made of iron, you can't get them that are 4.5 million years old. You only get a particular type of meteorite. It's called a chalandrite. And it seems to me that when you look at those, if you start taking clues from different parts of science and you construct a new picture, the new picture that you construct is different from the picture that we were told 150 years ago. For example, you have Jupiter. Jupiter, you know those meteorites that crashed on Jupiter and made those big explosions on Jupiter, the Shoemaker-Levy.
It's the comet, yeah.
Yeah, the Shoemaker-Levy things. Each one of those, there were 21 of them. They were all clustered together in one big ball. Each one of those is a planet killer. If one of them, one out of the 21, had hit the Earth, all life on Earth would be destroyed.
Yep. In an instant, almost.
In an instant. So what that does is it makes Jupiter into a kind of a meteorite umbrella. It seems to gather in all the big ones. If they get to a certain size, they seem to be gathered toward Jupiter. Otherwise, in our lifetime, it's impossible to believe that 21 of those planet killers could have hit Jupiter. Doesn't make any sense. And probably others will crash into Jupiter and we'll see them. It can't be that, I mean, I'm like Sherlock Holmes. I don't believe in coincidence. It doesn't make sense. That suddenly, we're looking up in space and 21 of these things crash into Jupiter and none of them crash into Earth. Never did. Never will.
Or even get close.
So what that means is that the likelihood is that Jupiter has grown big enough now to become our planetary umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
And that 600 million years ago, it wasn't so big. In fact, probably not so big at all.
That's true.
That's why when we look at the surface of Mars, we see what scientists call the old surface. And on the old surface, we see these big meteorite craters. And when we see the new surface, all we see are these little small meteorite craters. Same thing on Moon. If you look at the Moon, you see in certain areas, you see the old surface, which has these big meteorite craters. And then you see these things that are called mares, which people think is lava flow. I really don't think so.
Very smooth looking.
Very
right?
smooth. And if there are meteor craters, they're small. That essentially means that Jupiter has grown big enough. Now, we could say, well, there's no more big meteorites, but then there's Shoemaker-Levy, 21, hit Jupiter. I mean, you can make that argument, but the argument doesn't hold up. They hit Jupiter. Each one of them would have killed the Earth. Every one of those 21 would have killed the Earth. Jupiter is collecting them. That means that in our area of space, Jupiter has grown big enough to protect Mars and Earth from those big giant meteorites, or the facts are not correct. Now, if you look at that, and then you put it together with the size of the dinosaurs, and then you put it together with the oceans, and you put it together with lots of other facts from other sciences, and this is sort of what I've been doing for the last 30 years. I've studied all the sciences. I said to myself way back when those guys were sent back, those geologists were sent back in shame to Australia, I said to myself, you know, I just like to duck the flak here. I don't think I want to put my hand up and get it shot off by everybody who's saying that you can't prove that the Earth grew. I think I just want to draw my comic books and hide, and I'm going to study science. I'm going to study paleontology. I'm going to study physics. I'm going to study cosmology, and I'm going to figure out how come it's possible that a planet could grow. In other words, for a planet to grow, you'd have to be able to make matter, and you can't do that, of course. Right?
Well,
you know, it's funny about that.
I think the planet's alive, Neil.
Well, listen to this one. There's a guy named Carl David Anderson, youngest man on Earth to win the Nobel Prize. 1932, he was observing cosmic rays. We've actually seen films of this in school, and we use this technology. He's watching cosmic rays, and the way he does it is he empties this big space of air, makes a vacuum. Then he puts in certain trace elements of noble gases. These are the gases that have, you know, like argon and neon, gases that have the outer shell of their atom has 8 complete electrons. And what happens is if a cosmic ray goes through this very thin gas, it'll kind of disturb the gas and make a glowing trail. So in 1932, here's Carl David Anderson watching these glowing trails in what amounts to a vacuum, saying, my God, those are cosmic rays. Now, we've seen films on this, and this is a fact. This is nothing strange here. What happened is, somewhere along the line, seems like one of those cosmic rays hits something, bounces off to the side, and it creates a piece of matter. And that piece of matter goes off and finds an electron and annihilates it. That piece of matter is called a positron. Now, a positron is the opposite of an electron. Electron is those things that are on the outside of all atoms. Positron is the opposite of that. Positron is a positive electron. It exists long enough to find an electron and annihilate the electron, but it came from nowhere. A second ago, it didn't exist. It just spontaneously is created by the cosmic ray hitting something invisible and bringing it into existence. Not because I say so. I have nothing to do with this. I'm just reading the books. A couple of years later, other scientists watching this same experiment discover that when that positron is created, an electron is created at exactly the same time, and they go off at right angles to one another. Out of nothing, you get a positron and an electron. The positron finds another electron, annihilates it, so they both disappear, and now you have a new electron. Everything's okay. Everything is balanced. Einstein is right. Newton is right. Everybody's right. But if you look at it honestly, you say, gee, it looks like that matter was created out of nothing, because there was nothing there to begin with, and suddenly these two things were created. And one of them partially makes most of all of our atoms, electrons.
Does that tell you the planet is still growing, Neil?
Well, to me it says that if Sam Carey were a physicist, then he could go back and sit with his physicist friends and say, hey, let's talk about how matter can be created. And if somebody were to say it can't be created, they'd have to say, well, it can be created here. You can create an electron and a positron out of nothing. Now, wouldn't it be interesting if you could take that positron and you could put it through a process and turn it into a proton? Because if you could do that, you could take that electron and you could take that positron, turn it into a proton, and you would make hydrogen. And if you could make hydrogen, you could make a universe.
So true.
Now, if that's happening, if a process like that or similar to that is happening inside the Earth, inside the Sun, inside all the planets, then what we have, now I don't want to get anybody excited here, but what we have is we have a growing universe, which means that there was no Big Bang.
That's another. Just, you know,
that
why
just
is
gets
it
me in trouble here? See?
Well, no, not necessarily.
You went and got me in trouble
because I have always had a difficult time believing in the Big Bang theory. Now, scientists.
Well, I don't like to laugh out loud, but I agree with you. I think it's a preposterous theory, and it doesn't explain anything. Think about it. Universe exploded, it goes back. It exploded, it goes back. It exploded, it goes back. It's just a process. What we want to know is, where did the universe come from in the first place?
Exactly.
In other words, if you believe that it always existed and all the matter that existed here always existed, it always will exist, that's one theory. If you think that you had a universe where you had, let's call it pre-matter, something, okay, what they used to call ether, mm-hmm. and you could make a piece of matter out of it, with energy, and then you can make another and another and another until you had the universe that you had today. The question you'd have to ask is, who turned off the off switch?
And
it
who
does
also
make sense that if the universe was created, then it's still being created.
Well, I'm also nobody's concerned about who turned it on.
Well, you know, I think everybody's concerned about that, but you know, I don't know. And I
Neil,
don't pretend to know.
When we come back, can I chat with you about the possibility of multiple universes? I want to get your thought on that.
Oh, but you can, you know, but in all honesty, I have no idea.
I know, but you know what? Nobody does. Stay with us. Back in a moment. How would you like to be a StreamLink member and take advantage of podcasting and downloading programs and just everything else? You can do that. In the old days, we used to sell tapes of shows. It's well worth just StreamLink because the tapes, you know, after a while, they were $25, $30 a cassette. StreamLink is just pennies a day. So take advantage of it. If you want more information on StreamLink, you can just go to the coasttocoastam.com website. And we're talking with Neil Adams, legendary comic creator, and also, I can't call you a scientist, Neil.
No,
but
you can't do that.
You can't do that.
Can't
just
do that.
Some guy
maybe
with the ability to theorize.
Maybe scientist.
One
of those people that studies everything.
Did the moon grow as well, you
sure.
think?
Everything would have to grow. I mean, the problem with a theory like this is if it works for one, it has to work for the other. You can't just say that the Earth grew. It's another problem that Carey had. You know, he said the Earth grew. But that leads to, by logical extension, to the idea that everything grows. And you must have a theory that explains how everything can grow. And you can't back off of it, or else you can't say that the Earth can grow. And without having a theory, without having a concept, even a concept, you can't say it. And I don't say it. I simply say there's, you know, my mom told me to think in terms of percentages. There's a percentage of things that can be possible, and there's a percentage of this. And what you do is you look for a better percentage. That's what I've been doing for 30 years. I've been studying all these sciences and studying these things that you see. For example, one of the videos that you have there is of the moon. And they have what they call mares on the moon. Now, they're basically these big spread areas. And you know that one side of the moon faces the Earth, and one side of the moon faces away from the Earth all the time.
Yep.
That's the way it is. Pretty incredible when you think about it. There has to be a reason. And the reason has to fit into a theory. So there are scientists who used to believe, or some of them even still do believe, that those used to be, those mares, those big spread areas, were volcanoes. The logic is that if they were volcanoes, they'd be on the other side of the moon, too. Now, when I investigated these things from the point of view of this theory, I realized that what those things were pretty much the same things as we have with the oceans. They're big spread areas. In other words, something is created inside of the moon, comes to the surface, spreads the surface, and pushes the edges out, just like on the Earth, or on Enceladus, or on Ganymede, or any other moon and any other planet that's a solid rocky planet. So if that's true, if what I say is true, then what you have are these big spread areas, like sort of on a geode. You know what a geode is? Geode is you dig it up from the Earth, and it's like a rock. It's round. You cut it in half, and inside are crystals, beautiful purple and different color crystals. And you kind of look at it and go, how did that get made? That's incredible.
Yeah.
Looks like it grew like a plant. Well, think of the moon like that. It grows from the inside. If that happens, then you get these spread areas. And I realized looking at the moon, wow, you know, our moon has these incredibly big spread areas. I can make Jackie Gleason's face out of that. And I looked at these spread areas and I thought, that's what's going on here. That it's the surface is growing and spreading out like our oceans and pushing the edges aside. And then I realized, you know, what's interesting about our moon, different from all other moons, is that it doesn't spin the same way. That is, since it faces the Earth, the logic is that if something is growing from the inside, then the attraction of the Earth would cause that growth to be happening toward the Earth. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The gravity of the Earth would be pulling on it.
Pull it right on.
So if there's growth going on, which would be a subtle kind of thing, matter is being made and pushing toward the surface, it would grow toward the Earth. So logically, there would be more of these mirrors facing the Earth than facing the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, of course, I sweated that one because I could blow my theory out of the water with that one. Because if there are mirrors on the other side of the moon, that means that what I'm saying doesn't make any sense. So I let myself sweat for about a week on that one before I got photos. Of course, we do have photos of the other side of the moon.
That's right.
Turns out there are no mirrors on the other side of the moon.
And your theory lives again.
It lived for one more week. Waiting to be shot down by logical and sensible people.
Well, what do you think? Yeah, but nobody's been able to do that yet.
You know, it's true. It's true.
What do you think the universe looked like if you take out the Big Bang theory?
Okay, I'll give you a sense of it if I can. Essentially, what you have to do is let's say you start simple. You have to start simple. It makes all the sense in the world that you start simple. I know this. In a way, I'm saying something that's so obvious that it's very hard to argue with, but still, you know, scientists love to have complication. But I say, well, why don't we, for the sake of it, we'll talk simple. Let's just say you can take, cosmic rays, and you can hit this pre-matter stuff, and you can turn it into positrons and electrons, and you can go through a process to turn those positrons into protons. Sounds hard, but of course you're in a very, very early universe. What you can make is hydrogen. That's all you can make, because all you have are electrons and protons. You don't have neutrons. Very, very difficult to get neutrons, because we don't know how neutrons are made. We've seen electrons be made, and we've seen positrons be made. We don't know how protons are made and neutrons, but electrons we got. So let's just say we take this theory and we've got protons and neutrons. Whole universe filled with them, because after a while, keep on making them, you know, it gets pretty boring after all. You just fill the whole universe up with them. Some kind of energy causes these hydrogen atoms to gather, because, of course, they're not going to gather because they tend to be kind of anti-gravitational. They don't like to go near one another. So maybe you have some kind of force that brings them together. We'll call it spin, because it does seem like our universe has a spin on it. Certainly all the galaxies have spins and all the solar systems have spins. So you kind of, well, okay, I'll presuppose spin. And so you have spin, and you start spinning this stuff together, and after a while you get these bumps in this spin, you know, like in whirlpools. You have these little whirlpools within whirlpools. So what you get are suns. You don't get planets, and you don't get rocks, and you don't get moons. All you get are suns. So now you've got these suns. Now we've gone from nothing to hydrogen to suns, hydrogen suns. The thing about hydrogen is if you put enough hydrogen in one place and you make a sun out of it and you heat it up really good, it starts to go through a process where it makes helium. It makes helium by making neutrons. I realize I'm getting boring here, but you make neutrons, you can make helium. Now you've got a hydrogen sun that's got helium and hydrogen, but you don't have anything else. You don't have a solar system. So what you do is you heat up that sun, let it get bigger, let it grow, because it's going to create more of this stuff. Then you start firing this stuff out into its electromagnetic field. And that's sort of what goes on today. You know that our sun fires out 100 million tons of stuff from it every second?
Absolutely. And 100. We've been lucky some of the big stuff hasn't directly hit us.
Well, the question is it firing out big stuff? Or is it firing out simply ions and electrons? I don't think it's firing out any big stuff at all. Because all it has is hydrogen and helium. And those are just gases. So what it does is fires out hydrogen and helium. 100 million tons a second. Now, you multiply that over 5 billion years, you can build some planets with that. 100 million tons a second. Nobody sits and does the math. I don't know why. You sit and do the math on a calculator, you're going to end up with a lot of zeros. And the sun is firing them out. And still the sun seems to be growing. In fact, scientists will tell you that the sun has increased quite a bit since 3 billion years ago. And it's gotten a lot brighter.
Maybe that's another reason for global warming, huh?
Maybe. I think that what happens is you get a balance. You know, the planets move out as the sun grows. There's a certain balance to the universe. It makes sense. Now, that balance is probably likely, in my opinion. Of course, it's only opinion, fellas, so don't anybody jump on me here. It's an electromagnetic field of the sun that seems to allow the planets to live on it. In other words, the planets are set a certain distance apart. It's called Bode's Law. Neil's Law says that's an electromagnetic field, and we sit on the lines of electromagnetic field because, well, let me see, we're made out of iron for the most part, and iron is attracted to the lines around a magnet. So if the sun has an electromagnetic field, the biggest in our solar system, logically it has lines, or else magnetism doesn't work the way they tell us. So if that's the case, then planets that have iron cores, or there's a lot of cores and a lot of iron in the planet, will be attracted to those lines and then set at a certain distance out from the sun. And as the sun grows, the lines move outward and everything is logical and makes sense, or else it's chaos, as most scientists seem to think it is. So the sun is firing out electrons it fires out helium atoms. Okay. When it does that, it strips the atoms of the electrons. It has two electrons, two protons, two neutrons, and when it fires them out, it strips the electrons off. So when we get that solar wind coming from the sun, it's essentially electrons and ions. Ions are what's left after you take off the electrons. Take off the electrons, you got an ion, okay? And that's what the sun is firing out. Those ions are the core of a helium atom. Same thing with the hydrogen atom. Now, since the cores are flying out and there's no electrons, one of the things you learn in science is that you can't make an atom get any bigger because the electron shell protects it, doesn't allow any more protons and neutrons in.
Right.
So if you strip those electrons off, then it's very sensible to believe that those ions can join one another and make bigger count atoms, might even make iron. And then finally, when the electrons start to gather around it, they stop that growth and stop that atom from becoming any bigger. So what you have is you have a sun that has simply hydrogen and helium. It might have other material in the core, but essentially the stuff it fires off is hydrogen and helium. It fires it off, strips off the electrons, the ions fly out, join other ions, become higher count atoms, electrons wrap around them again, and now you have the material from which you can make a solar system. In other words, to put it simply, Mama Sun makes its own solar system.
And it's happening, I think, throughout the universe. The same pattern. It's everywhere.
And it's a pattern of sensible growth. It's not magic. It's not it suddenly disappeared. It's not all these meteorites were floating around. If you say that all these meteorites were floating around and gravity gathered them together, you have to explain where the meteorites came from. And if you say, well, they came from another sun that exploded, which is a rather curious idea, at some point you run out of suns to explode because as you go back in time, you have less and less material. So the logic is that you're making matter and then you're recomposing it and then you make the stuff that you have. Now, I'm not saying this is true. I'm just saying it's another view and one should be considered. Partially because the way science works is, in my opinion, but of course I think some scientists will agree, if you have a theory that tends to want to explain all this stuff, it has to explain everything that we know, and then it has to explain a whole bunch more things. That's what this theory does. It says, no, the universe didn't burst into existence. There was no Big Bang. What happened was you had nothing. You have pre-matter. We don't know what that is. You made hydrogen out of it. You gathered the hydrogen into suns. The suns, because they became suns, lit up, burned, created heat. That thermal heat caused the creation of neutrons. The neutrons created helium. The helium got blasted out into space, the electrons stripped off, the ions collected into higher count atoms. It creates the solar system. Now you have the solar system gathering around the sun.
But what a design, Neil, huh?
It's
what an incredible design.
You know, please, you guys, whoever's out there, don't write me letters and tell me, you know, like, I'm an idiot and all the rest of it. I agree I'm an idiot. I'm just a comic book artist, and I'm just looking at the pieces. I'm just looking at the pieces, and they make sense this way. And I can't, in all honesty, I can't find a hole in it. Now, what happens with all this is that if you do start with this kind of a theory, you basically say, if you think it's a complicated universe, if you think that there are all these other kinds of particles, why not we look at those particles that we do know and find out if whether or not these other particles are forms or energized forms or hidden forms of these same particles? In other words, why do we want to get involved in a lot of different things? For example, okay, science tells us that there's such a thing as gravity and there's also electromagnetic force, and we're trying to unify these concepts. So I think I sit back and I go, well, you know, I know that science and the universe made negative and positive electromagnetic force. It's a little hard for me to imagine that nature or whatever it is sat back and said, well, I got this negative force, electromagnetic, I got this positive force. I'm not busy today. Why don't I make another positive force and I'll call it gravity? But, and somebody will come along and tap them on the shoulder and go, well, wait a second, you know, every action takes an equal and opposite reaction. If you're going to create gravity, you have to create like an anti-gravity. No, I don't want to do that. I just want to create a gravity. To me, that doesn't make sense. I like the electromagnetic positive force and the electromagnetic negative force.
Yes.
I find it a little hard to believe that gravity as a new force was created out of for no reason. Why do we already have the positive and the negative force. Why are we getting involved in a new positive force? Is there some way to hook that gravity into electromagnetic force? Because if there is a way, it would make the universe make a lot more sense.
Neil, I'm going to bring in for just a few moments here someone who loves your work. He's our science advisor. He also heads up the enterprisemission.com, Richard C. Hoagland.
Hey,
and
Richard
has come up with, you know, his theories of Mars and Cydonia. Hey, Richard, a few minutes left. Come on in. Are you there? Well, where did he go?
I don't know.
Well, we'll get him back on and make sure we can take advantage of that as quickly as possible. He was there,
okay?
Because I saw his name on our screen.
I'm sure.
He's the one who's come up with the theory of the face on Mars.
Ah, well, you know, there are some interesting things about Mars. People keep trying to find water on Mars. I don't honestly think they're going to find any standing water on Mars. They might find what you call upgassing from the inside of the planet, which is exactly how we get water on Earth, because it's got to come from somewhere, and I don't think it comes from my Aunt Nettie's house.
Let's try Richard again.
Sure.
There you are. You're there, Richard?
I'm here now.
My incredible computer system. And but go ahead, like, because I'm nipping into your questioning here.
Well, first of all, I want to congratulate Neil on being an exquisite expositor of a group of geologists who have not gotten a lot of mainstream press, a lot of scientific publicity, but who've been quietly working for years on exactly this idea.
Exactly.
Namely, that the Earth and other planets expand. And the one thing that Neil didn't say, which obviously is because he's so familiar with this, he kind of said it in his mind, but he didn't say it to you. The only way this works is if there is the creation of matter in planets, in stars.
Exactly.
Which in the HD model, the hyperdimensional model, is an exact prediction along with the energy that these planets and stars are emitting. It's coming from another dimension. It's the inverse of E equals MC squared, where you take energy from another dimension and convert it into matter in this dimension. And it explains the dark energy problem, why the universe is accelerating, apparently, away from someplace, although I agree that the Big Bang, per se, did not happen. Anyway, I just have to hand it to you, Neil. You have given an extraordinarily cogent explanation for all the folks that are not scientists of a very important idea. And it is obviously for the first time again on Coast, another first, George. And I just have to hand it to both you guys for giving us a terrifically entertaining and informative evening.
Well, thank you. How very nice.
Now I got a question.
Go ahead.
Neil, did you ever know Jack Kirby?
Yeah, sure.
Did you know this was what I published Monday on the Enterprise Mission website?
To tell everybody that Jack Kirby is probably what a king of comic
books. Oh, yeah. You got to tell who Jack Kirby is.
Because you left something out there. Jack Kirby is probably, besides Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, the greatest comic book artist that ever lived.
20-some thousand pages, I believe.
Oh, my God.
Exactly.
Incredible guy. He also was a multidimensional guy, and he created most of the characters that are made into these movies, like the Hulk and Spider-Man and... You know, the Fantastic Four, and I mean, he had.
And wouldn't it be nice if his family? Wouldn't it be nice if his family got some of the royalties?
Wouldn't it be wonderful?
Not again.
Wonderful?
Just putting out that message.
Here is my question, and I'll get off the air, and you can answer it after the break because you're going to need a little time to answer this.
Sure.
At the Enterprise Mission website, we have a new post was done up Monday for the Mars mission going to basically go into orbit, the proper orbit in October, called MRO. And it's called Forbidden Planet, .. Mars. And it's going to come in several parts. In part one, George, if you have the time to scan down, you'll notice that I included a cover of a comic from 1958.
I'm going to have to let you ask him the question when we come back, Bridget. We'll be back.